Have you ever looked at your paycheck and then looked at your monthly bills and just wondered why it feels like you're running on a treadmill that just keeps speeding up?
Oh, yeah, I think we all have.
Right, like you're sweating, you're putting in the hours, you're doing, everything you were taught to do,
Exactly.
but somehow you are barely staying in the exact same place.
Yeah.
Well, you aren't crazy. It's not just your imagination, and it's definitely not like some personal budgeting failure on your
Oh,
part.
no, not at all.
The American economy has basically fundamentally changed its physics, and today we have a massive stack of data that actually proves it.
We really do. And, that feeling of running on a treadmill, it's the lived experience of a massive structural shift.
Yeah.
If we want to understand the rising political temperature in this country, the anger, the fractured communities, we can't just look at what politicians are saying on TV.
Right, you have to look deeper.
Exactly. We first have to look at our bank accounts.
So, okay, let's unpack this. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are decoding this comprehensive 2026 research report. It's titled American Inequality and Polarization.
It's a heavy read, but a crucial one.
It really is. So, our mission for this deep dive is to look at the structural forces dividing the United States, separate the actual hard data from all the political rhetoric out there, and explain the mechanics of why the country feels so incredibly fractured right now.
And we really have to start with the foundational economic reality that you, the listener, are navigating every single day.
Because it's rough out there.
It is. And to do that, the report draws a very hard line between two concepts that usually get blended together in the media.
Oh, income and wealth, right.
Yes, income and wealth, they represent entirely different forms of
All
inequality.
right.
Income is a flow. It's the wages you get every 2 weeks, or the dividends from a stock. It is money moving.
Okay.
Wealth, on the other hand, is a stock. It is the accumulated assets you own outright, your house, your retirement account, your savings, minus your debts.
Reading the report, it makes me think of like a plumbing system.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, so income is the water flowing from the tap, but wealth is the reservoir holding the water.
Right, exactly.
And for half the country, that reservoir just has a massive unpluggable leak.
That is a perfect way to look at it. So let's look at the tap first. The data from the Census Bureau shows that in 2024, the median household income was $83,730.
Which, I mean, on paper, that sounds fairly robust, right?
Yeah, it sounds like a solid middle-class flow of water.
Yeah.
But then you look at the reservoir. A 2025 Federal Reserve survey found that only 63% of adults could cover a $400 emergency expense with cash or its equivalent.
Wait, hold on.
Yeah.
Median income is over $83,000, but nearly 4 in 10 people can't scrape together 400 bucks for like a broken alternator or an unexpected medical bill.
I know, it's wild.
Yeah.
But that is the extreme vulnerability of having income without wealth. Wealth is the shock absorber. If you don't have wealth, a relatively minor $400 emergency forces you into this catastrophic, bad option trap.
Like putting it on a credit card.
Exactly. You have to take on high-interest credit card debt, or maybe you resort to a payday loan with a 400% interest rate.
Ugh, those are brutal.
Or worse, you simply can't fix the car. So you miss a shift at work, which threatens your job, which instantly cuts off your income flow entirely.
So the whole system is just entirely precarious.
Completely. And when we zoom out to look at the aggregate wealth in the United States, I mean, the sheer scale of the money is staggering.
Oh, yeah, the numbers in the report were huge.
By early 2026, the Fed estimated total household and nonprofit net worth at about $183 trillion.
Trillion with a T.
With a T.
But I'm assuming that $183 trillion reservoir is pretty heavily partitioned.
You would assume correctly. According to the Congressional Budget Office data leading up to 2022, the top 1% holds 27% of all family wealth.
27%, just for the top 1%.
Yep. And the bottom 50% of the country. So half the entire population holds just 6%.
Just 6% of the wealth. That's insane. So what is eating the flow before it can reach the reservoir for that bottom 50%? Like, where is the leak?
It's the unprecedented cost of simply maintaining a basic middle-class existence.
Right.
The structural expenses have just completely decoupled from wage growth. In 2023, nearly 50% of all renters were cost-burdened.
Meaning what exactly in economic terms?
It means they spent over 30% of their gross income just to keep a roof over their heads. Yeah.
Jeez.
And then you layer on health care. National health expenditures hit $5.3 trillion in 2024.
Wow.
Then you layer on higher education, which has skyrocketed, and childcare, which in many states costs as much as college tuition right now.
So the water is flowing out of the tap, but it's immediately rushing down the drain just to cover basic survival.
Exactly. There is literally nothing left over to pull into the wealth reservoir.
So to you listening, this is the exact mechanism behind why you might feel completely financially insecure despite having what society considers a quote-unquote good job.
Right.
The math simply doesn't work the way it used to. But, you know, looking at the report, we know it wasn't always this precarious.
No, it wasn't. To understand the shift, the report actually maps out the last 100 years of American economic history.
Right.
And it basically forms a giant U-shape.
Okay, a U-shape.
Yeah. In the early 20th century, during the Gilded Age, wealth was highly concentrated at the top. But then we entered what economists call the Great Compression in the mid-20th century.
Oh, like the post-World War II era.
Exactly.
The golden age of the American middle class, right? With the white picket fences and the single-income households.
That's the one.
Mm-hmm.
And that was driven by very aggressive structural policies. You had the New Deal, wartime economic controls, mass unionization, and highly progressive taxation.
Where the top marginal tax rates were like astronomically high compared to today.
Very high, yes. And because of that, wages for the working class grew rapidly, compressing the gap between the rich and the poor.
Okay, so that's the bottom of the U-shape.
Right. The middle class expanded its asset ownership primarily through government-backed mortgages for housing. But, and this is crucial, we have to look at the complete historical picture here.
Right, because it wasn't a golden age for everybody.
No. That Great Compression was intentionally racially exclusionary.
Because the policies didn't apply to everyone equally.
Exactly. Agricultural and domestic workers' professions, heavily populated by Black Americans, were initially carved out of labor protections entirely.
Wow.
Furthermore, federal housing policies relied on the literal practice of redlining.
Right, I've heard of that.
Yeah, the government and banks drew actual red lines on maps around predominantly Black and minority neighborhoods, deeming them hazardous for investment.
So they explicitly denied government-backed mortgages to people living inside those red lines.
Precisely. So an entire generation of Black Americans was systematically cut off from the single greatest wealth-building tool in American history, which is home equity.
So we have this massive government-subsidized expansion of the middle class that fundamentally locked out minorities.
Exactly.
But eventually, that U-shape broke.
Right.
Right? And inequality went soaring back up for the broader working class as well.
Yeah, the turning point really solidifies in the late 1970s and early 1980s.
What happened then?
Well, the 1970s brought brutal oil shocks and stagflation, which discredited the old economic consensus and paved the way for the neoliberal turn.
Okay.
This was a sweeping ideological shift toward deregulation, drastically lower marginal tax rates, and the embrace of free trade and globalization.
Right.
Simultaneously, there was a concerted effort to dismantle the institutions that gave workers bargaining power.
Yeah.
Union membership just went into freefall.
I saw those numbers in the report. They were pretty staggering.
Very. In 1983, the union membership rate was 20.1%. By 2025, it was down to 10% overall.
Wow.
Yep. And in the private sector, it's virtually non-existent. It's at just 5.9%.
And while bargaining power collapsed, the wage floor completely rotted out, right? I mean, the federal minimum wage has been sitting at $7.25 an hour since July 2009.
It really is wild when you think about it.
It hasn't moved a single cent in over 15 years. Mm. Inflation has just steadily, quietly eaten away its actual purchasing power year after year.
So when you weaken collective bargaining, freeze the minimum wage, and simultaneously supercharge technology, offshore manufacturing, and deregulate finance,
right?
Capital suddenly holds all the leverage over labor.
Wait, hold on, though. Let me push back on the timeline a bit. What about the 2020s?
Okay.
I mean, the government pumped trillions of dollars into the economy during the pandemic. We had multiple rounds of stimulus checks, expanded unemployment benefits, the Paycheck Protection Program.
Right, the PPP loans.
Yeah, didn't that massive intervention like close the wealth gap at all?
So that is the great paradox of the 2020s. And the report actually spends a lot of time on this.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Those pandemic transfers were incredibly effective at providing temporary poverty relief. They kept people fed and housed during a global crisis.
Right. The bucket was working.
Yes. But at the exact same time, to keep the broader financial system from collapsing, the Federal Reserve dropped interest rates down to zero.
Meaning borrowing money became practically free.
Exactly. And when borrowing is free, institutional investors and large funds take that cheap money and pour it into assets looking for a return.
Oh.
They buy up real estate, they flood the stock market. That artificially drives up the price of those assets.
Ah, I see where this is going.
Right. If you already owned a house, its value skyrocketed because everyone was bidding on property with cheap debt. If you owned a robust stock portfolio, it boomed.
But if you didn't own those assets, if you were part of that bottom 50% relying solely on the pandemic cash relief, you were left facing the brutal post-pandemic inflation without any compounding wealth cushion to protect you.
That's it, exactly. The divide between the owners and the non-owners didn't close. The mechanism of cheap debt actually widened it.
Man. So this historical shift didn't just alter our bank accounts. Looking at the report, it literally rewrote the physical map of opportunity in America.
It did. Geographic inequality is huge here.
Right, because where you live is no longer just a scenic backdrop to your life. For you listening, your zip code basically operates as an inequality machine, actively determining your net worth, your health outcomes, and your kids' futures.
The report highlights the extreme divergence between what they call the superstar city and the deindustrialized local labor market.
Let's talk about the superstar cities first.
Okay, take a major tech or finance hub on the coasts. These cities generate massive wages and incredible economic productivity.
Right.
But they are plagued by restrictive, exclusionary zoning laws. Local homeowners heavily restrict the construction of new high-density housing because restricting supply keeps the value of their own homes artificially high.
Oh, wow. So the existing homeowners capture all that massive economic growth simply by owning the land.
Exactly.
While the working class, the teachers, the service workers, the nurses are entirely priced out of the city limits or forced into grueling, like, two-hour commutes.
That's exactly what's happening. And on the flip side of that map, you have towns and regions that relied heavily on a single industry or a major factory.
Right, the deindustrialized areas.
Yeah. When globalization or automation closes that factory, the economic damage doesn't stop at the laid-off workers' wages. It destroys the entire local tax base.
Because the corporate taxes disappear.
Right. And without corporate taxes and strong income taxes, the local schools lose funding. The hospitals consolidate or close. Small businesses shutter.
But it's a total domino effect.
Property values tank, which means the people living there can't even sell their homes to move somewhere else with better opportunities.
They are financially trapped in a dying local economy.
Yes.
And this geographic sorting, it interacts directly with the legacy of historical racial inequality we mentioned earlier, doesn't it?
It does, in a major way.
When we look at the compounding interests of history, you know, the redlining, the unequal GI Bill, who inherited a house from their grandparents and who didn't me, the racial wealth gap in the data is just staggering.
The 2022 data is very clear on this.
Yeah. I mean, median wealth is about $285,000 for white families.
Right.
But just $44,900 for black families.
It's a massive gap.
And $61,600 for Hispanic families.
And for Asian families, the median is around $536,000. Though the report does note there is extreme variation in that group depending on national origin and when they immigrated.
Right. There's a lot of subgroups there.
Exactly. But overall, this physical, financial, and racial separation destroys something critically important to social mobility.
What's that?
The report cites massive data sets from Opportunity Insights showing that economic connectedness is one of the absolute strongest predictors of upward mobility for children.
Economic connectedness, so basically cross-class friendships.
Yes, exactly.
It's like the invisible network of opportunity.
Right.
It's the friend's parent who can recommend you for an internship, or just, you know, the exposure to different career paths, or the soft skills of navigating different social circles.
But because we're increasingly sorted into entirely separate, homogeneous neighborhoods based strictly on what housing we can afford.
Those cross-class social ties are disappearing.
Yes. The rich kids and the poor kids don't go to the same schools, they don't play in the same parks, and their parents don't interact.
So if you have millions of people who are physically separated by zip code, socially separated by a lack of cross-class connection, and financially separated by a massive wealth gap, that creates an immense social vacuum. And nature abhors a vacuum.
It certainly does.
And that is exactly where the political parties step in.
Right. The report actually labels American polarization as partisanized inequality.
Partisanized inequality.
Yeah. The central argument here is that Our political divide is not just an illusion created by social media algorithms or, you know, people yelling at each other on cable news.
Right.
It is the direct translation of these deep, very real material insecurities into competing political narratives.
And I want to be really clear to you listening here. We are just looking at the structural anatomy of these movements as reported in the data. We are absolutely not taking a side.
Right. We're just analyzing the mechanics.
Yeah. And if we look at this strictly through the lens of political science and the data in front of us, both major political movements are highly rational reactions to a broken economic machine.
Exactly. They just diagnose the disease differently.
Let's break that down. Look at the Maggier movement first.
Okay. The data shows it heavily mobilizes around economic nationalism, cultural traditionalism, and a deep systemic skepticism of federal bureaucracy and mainstream institutions.
Mm-hmm.
It draws massive support from non-college and rural voters, basically converting the very real grievance of deindustrialization and hollowed-out towns into a conflict with what it perceives as cosmopolitan, condescending elites.
And then on the other side, you have progressivism and democratic socialism.
Right.
Their narrative frames this exact same inequality as a structural conflict over corporate concentration, labor exploitation, and historical discrimination.
Yes. Their base is much stronger in dense urban centers and among highly educated younger voters.
The people who are staring down massive student debt and impossible housing markets.
Exactly. And both of these grassroots movements are operating inside a system heavily weighted toward established wealth.
Right.
The report highlights this landmark research by Martin Gielens and Benjamin Page, which tracked how policy actually gets made.
This part blew my mind.
Yeah, it's pretty bleak. They found that affluent preferences and elite business groups have vastly more influence on policy adoption than average citizens.
So essentially, if the bottom 90% of earners support a policy, it has almost zero independent impact on whether it becomes law.
Almost zero. But if the economic elite support it, the odds of it passing skyrocket.
Wow.
And to give you a sense of the sheer scale of elite capture, independent political expenditures.
Oh.
So money spent by outside groups, not the candidates themselves, hit $4.4 billion in the 2023-2024 election cycle alone.
$4.4 billion. Okay, so I have to ask a question here.
Sure.
If both Maggi and progressives are furious at the system and both claim to be fighting, quote unquote, the elites, why don't they join forces?
Right.
Like, why isn't there a massive unified working class coalition against this elite capture? Why do they hate each other so much?
Honestly, this is genuinely the most fascinating part of the data to me.
Really?
Yes. It is a complete structural mismatch. They are both using the exact same word elite, but they are speaking two entirely different languages.
Oh, so.
The political left defines the elite vertically. They're looking up and down the economic ladder. They target billionaires, corporate monopolies, and landlord power.
Okay, vertically.
But the political right defines the elite horizontally. They are looking left and right across the cultural divide. They target cultural elites, academia, Hollywood, and federal bureaucrats.
Oh, wow. So progressives want to tax the billionaire while Maggio wants to defund the Ivy League bureaucrats.
Exactly. They're both firing their weapons at the elites, but their guns are pointed in entirely different directions.
That is just brilliant political alchemy.
It really is, because the parties bundle these divergent definitions of the elite with highly emotional, existential, cultural issues, things like religion, race, bodily autonomy, and national identity.
Right, the stuff that really gets people riled up.
Yes. Those raw, cross-cutting economic grievances are converted into incredibly durable, hostile partisan identities. You end up hating the person on the other side of the cultural divide more than the system that is bankrupting both of you.
So we basically just get trapped in this rhetorical loop, fighting proxy wars while the wealth reservoir keeps leaking.
That's the tragic reality of it, yeah.
Okay, so since our politics are trapped in this loop, let's look outside the U.S. for a minute.
Okay.
What actually works to fix the structural divide in other democracies?
Well, the international comparison is pretty sobering, to be honest.
Uh-oh.
As of June 2026, the U.S. has the highest disposable income Gini coefficient among its peer nations.
Okay, just to visualize that for everyone listening, the Gini coefficient operates on a scale from 0 to 1. 0 means perfect equality, where everyone has the exact same amount, and 1 is absolute inequality, where a single person holds literally everything.
Right, and the U.S. is drifting uncomfortably close to that one. far more than countries like Canada, the UK, Germany, or the Nordic nations.
Yeah.
We also have the highest relative poverty rate among that peer group.
Why? Are those countries just, like, naturally more altruistic than us?
No, no, it's purely institutional. The U.S. relies on highly decentralized wage bargaining. Our health insurance is tied directly to our employers rather than being universal. Our local zoning laws are fiercely exclusionary, and our welfare state is fragmented, incredibly difficult to navigate.
Right.
Economists divide the policy levers to fix this into two broad categories, Predistribution and redistribution.
Okay, so this goes back to our leaky pipe analogy.
Exactly.
Redistribution is the bucket. It's things like taxes, food stamps, and welfare checks. We are trying to catch the water after it has already leaked out of the pipe.
Right.
But other countries are focusing heavily on the valve itself. That's pre-distribution.
Mm-hmm.
So higher minimum wages, robust union protections, and aggressive antitrust laws that change how the money flows between workers and corporations before taxes are even collected.
That's exactly it. You need a functional valve and a functional bucket.
Yeah.
And the data shows that when the U.S. actually uses a bigger bucket, it works instantly. The report points to the incredible concrete success of the 2021 child tax credit expansion.
Oh, right. Because that was a simple, direct cash transfer to families.
Exactly.
No massive bureaucracy, just direct held. What was the result of that?
It temporarily lifted 2.1 million children above the poverty line in a single year.
Wow.
The overall child poverty rate dropped to a historic record low of 5.2%.
That's amazing.
But because it was temporary, it eventually expired in Congress. And the moment the bucket was taken away, child poverty shot right back up to its previous levels.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, it shows that international experience and our own recent history proves this is a choice.
Yes. Exactly. It is a choice, not destiny.
We have the policy tools to fix the U-shape, to patch the reservoir, and to tighten the valve.
We do. The ultimate takeaway from this 2026 report is that American polarization is a completely rational response to our current system.
Right.
Wealth right now acts as a massive flywheel. It compounds advantage for the people who already have it, buying them better zip codes, better schools, and vastly more political access, while the economic engine just stalls out for everyone else.
So understanding the architecture of this machine is really the first step to seeing through the daily political noise.
Absolutely.
It empowers you to realize that people aren't just angry for no reason. They are reacting to a machine that is functioning exactly as it was built to function.
And the scary part is that machine is about to face its biggest stress test yet.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
The report looks ahead to the 2026 to 2036 decade and points to one massive looming variable. Generative AI.
Right. Up until now, automation has mostly hollowed out factory towns and routine physical labor.
Yes.
But advanced AI is coming directly for the white-collar professional knowledge worker class. Lawyers, coders, middle management, analysts.
Which leaves us with a really profound question. What happens when the economic position of the professional class, the people who have largely benefited from the current system, begins to stall out and face the exact same precarity as the deindustrialized working class?
Will this shared technological disruption finally create a cross-class unified coalition that bridges the current vertical and horizontal partisan divides?
Or will AI simply supercharge the inequality machine, consolidate even more wealth into the hands of the few tech monopolies that own the models, and just break the political system entirely?
That is the defining question we're all going to have to answer over the next decade.
Definitely.
Think about that the next time you look at your paycheck and feel like you're sweating on that treadmill. The machine is speeding up, but now at least you know exactly how the murder works.
Knowledge is power.
It really is. Thank you so much for taking this deep dive with us. See you next time.